Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Nau mai, haere mai. I'm John McDonald. Kia ora and welcome into the Community Drive Hut Zone on Thursday the 4th of December. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the stories, people, poems and music that make the Hutt Valley community. Tonight, we meet a visiting Australian bush poet, Gregory North, before his tribute concert on Saturday night for Banjo Patterson at Staglands Cafe in Upper Hutt. We sample some of his music and poems. We hear another reading from Catherine Mansfield's first published book in A German Pension. Today it's At Lehrmann's. And there's music from Darren Watson, Lincoln Town, the Drongos perform Ghost Ship, and there's a bit of Christmas spirit from Cantorus Choir ahead of their end-of-year concert on Saturday afternoon. Let's start the show off with a poetry reading from Dr. Peter Simpson. It's of James K. Baxter's poem, There Is Only One Direction.
Ruo has seen, better indeed than most, the face of suffering in the dirty slum transfigured. Against the sky of arson, black as man's disgrace, hanging the mortal Christ abandoned by men. Thence all renewals come, at the live quick of time, our crimes wrench on the rack. And you too, in this ruinous country, have guessed there is no otherwise. The kirk cleft by a thunderbolt, those queer gaunt women strung like liars to suffer with him. You know the rock under the anxiety, under the smiling breast, that all things travail on a bed of fires. The impure heart rebels and aches for death. Chiefly, I am contented with that peasant face you painted, the brooding natural tenderness of mother and child. He draws his milk and breath from love's deep equipoise. So time and place give ground for hope, for the bruised herb, forgiveness.
And that was Dr. Peter Simpson reading James K. Baxter's poem, There Is Only One Direction. Let's hear some Upper Hutt connected music now. Ghost Ship from the Drongos.
Sometimes in the strangest ways, in the strangest places.
And that was Upper Hutt's The Drongos and Ghost Ship. Let's travel back to 1911 and hear another story from Catherine Mansfield's book, In a German Pension.
Lehrman's by Catherine Mansfield, narrated by Harry Dobby. Certainly, Sabina did not find life slow. She was on the trot from early morning until late at night. At 5 o'clock, she tumbled out of bed, buttoned on her clothes, wearing a long-sleeved alpaca pinafore over her black frock, and groped her way downstairs into the kitchen. Anna, the cook, had grown so fat during the summer that she adored her bed because she did not have to wear her corsets there, but could spread as much as she liked, roll about under the great mattress, calling upon Jesus and Holy Mary and Blessed Anthony himself, that her life was not fit for a pig in a cellar. Sabina was new to her work. Pink colour still flew in her cheeks. There was a little dimple on the left side of her mouth, that even when she was most serious, most absorbed, popped out and gave her away. And Anna blessed that dimple. It meant an extra half hour in bed for her. It made Sabina light the fire, turn out the kitchen, and wash endless cups and saucers that had been left over from the evening before. Hans, the scullery boy, did not come until 7. He was the son of the butcher, a mean, undersized child, very much like one of his father's sausages, Sabina thought. His red face was covered with pimples, and his nails indescribably filthy. When Herr Lehrman himself told Hans to get a hairpin and clean them, he said they were stained from birth because his mother had always got so inky doing the accounts. And Sabina believed him and pitied him. Winter had come very early to Mindelbau. By the end of October, the streets were banked waist-high with snow, and the greater number of the cure guests, sick unto death of cold water and herbs, had departed in nothing approaching peace. So the large salon was shut at Lehrman's, and the breakfast room was all the accommodation the café afforded. Here the floor had to be washed over, the tables rubbed, coffee cups set out, each with its little china platter of sugar, and newspapers and magazines hung on their hooks along the walls before Herr Lehrman arrived at 7:30 and opened business. As a rule, his wife served in the shop leading into the café, but she had chosen the quiet season to have a baby, and, a big woman at the best of times, she had grown so enormous in the process that her husband told her she looked unappetizing and had better remain upstairs and sew. Sabina took on the extra work without any thought of extra pay. She loved to stand behind the counter, cutting up slices of Anna's marvellous chocolate-spotted confections, or doing up packets of sugar almonds in pink and blue striped bags. "You'll get varicose veins like me," said Anna. "That's what the Frau's got too. No wonder the baby doesn't come. All her swellings got into her legs." And Hans was immensely interested. During the morning, business was comparatively slack. Sabina answered the shop bell, attended to a few customers who drank a liqueur to warm their stomachs before the midday meal, and ran upstairs now and again to ask the Frau if she wanted anything. But in the afternoon, 6 or 7 choice spirits played cards, and everybody who was anybody drank tea or coffee. "Sabina! Sabina!" She flew from one table to the other, counting out handfuls of small change, giving orders to Anna through the slide, helping the men with their heavy coats, always with that magical child air about her, that delightful sense of perpetually attending a party. "How is the Frau Lehrman?" the women would whisper. "She feels rather low, but as well as can be expected," Sabina would answer, nodding confidentially. Frau Lehrmann's bad time was approaching. Anna and her friends referred to it as her journey to Rome, and Sabina longed to ask questions, yet, being ashamed of her ignorance, was silent, trying to puzzle it out for herself. She knew practically nothing, except that the Frau had a baby inside her, which had to come out. Very painful indeed. One could not have one without a husband. That she also realised. But what had the man got to do with it? So she wondered as she sat mending tea towels in the evening, head bent over her work, light shining on her brown curls. Birth. What was it? Wondered Sabina. Death. Such a simple thing. She had a little picture of her dead grandmother dressed in a black silk frock, tired hands clasping the crucifix that dragged between her flattened breasts, mouth curiously tight, yet almost secretly smiling. But the grandmother had been born once. That was the important part. As she sat there one evening, thinking, the young man entered the cafe and called for a glass of port wine. Sabina rose slowly. The long day and the hot room made her feel a little languid, but as she poured out the wine, she felt the young man's eyes fixed on her, looking down at him, and dimpled. "It's cold out," she said, corking the bottle. The young man ran his hands through his snow-powdered hair and laughed. "I wouldn't exactly call it tropical," he said. "But you're very snug in here. Look as though you've been asleep." Very languid, felt Sabina in the hot room, and the young man's voice was strong and deep. She thought she had never seen anybody who looked so strong, as though he could take up the table in one hand, and his restless gaze wandering over her face and figure gave her a curious thrill deep in her body, half pleasure, half pain. She wanted to stand there, close beside him, while he drank his wine. A little silence followed. Then he took a book out of his pocket, and Sabina went back to her sewing. Sitting there in the corner, she listened to the sound of the leaves being turned, and the loud ticking of the clock that hung over the gilt mirror. She wanted to look at him again. There was a something about him, in his deep voice, even in the way his clothes fitted. From the room above, she heard the heavy, dragging sound of Frau Lehrmann's footsteps. And again the old thoughts worried Sabina. If she herself should one day look like that, feel like that. Yet it would be very sweet to have a little baby to dress and jump up and down.
"Fraulein, what's your name? What are you smiling at?" called the young man.
She blushed and looked up, hands quiet in her lap, looked across the empty tables, and shook her head.
"Come here, and I'll show you a picture," he commanded.
She went and stood beside him. He opened the book, and Sabina saw a colourful sketch of a naked girl sitting on the edge of a great, crumpled bed, a man's opera hat on the back of her head. He put his hand over the body, leaving only the face exposed, then scrutinised Sabina closely.
"Well,
what do you mean?" she asked, knowing perfectly well.
"Why, it might be your own photograph. The face, I mean. That's as far as I can judge."
"But the hair's done differently," said Sabina, laughing. She threw back her head, and the laughter bubbled in her round white throat.
"It's a rather nice picture, don't you think?" he asked.
But she was looking at a curious ring he wore on the hand that covered the girl's body, and only nodded.
"Ever seen anything like it before?"
"Oh, there's plenty of those funny ones in the illustrated papers."
"How would you like to have your picture taken that way?"
"Me? I'd never let anybody see it. Besides, I haven't got a hat like that."
"That's easily remedied."
Again, a little silence, broken by Anna throwing up the slide. Sabina ran into the kitchen.
"Here, Take this milk and egg up to the Frau, said Anna. Who have you got in there?
Such a funny man. I think he's a little gone here, tapping her forehead. Upstairs in the ugly room, the Frau sat sewing, a black shawl round her shoulders, her feet encased in red woolen slippers. The girl put the milk on a table by her, then stood, polishing a spoon on her apron. Anything else?
Nah, said the Frau, heaving up in her chair. Where's my man?
He's playing cards over at Snipold's. Do you want him?
Dear heaven, leave him alone. I'm nothing. I don't matter. And the whole day waiting here.
Her hand shook as she wiped the rim of the glass with her fat finger. Shall I help you to bed?
You go downstairs, leave me alone. Tell Anna not to let Hans grub the sugar. Give him one on the ear.
Ugly, 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 muttered Sabina, returning to the cafe where the young man stood coat buttoned, ready for departure.
I'll come again tomorrow, said he. Don't twist your hair back so tightly. It will lose all its curl.
Well, you are a funny one, she said. Good night. By the time Sabina was ready for bed, Anna was snoring. She brushed out her long hair and gathered it in her hands. Perhaps it would be a pity if it lost all its curl. Then she looked down at her straight chemise and, drawing it off, sat down on the side of the bed. I wish, she whispered, smiling sleepily, that there was a great big mirror looking glass in this room. Lying down in the darkness, she hugged her little body. I wouldn't be the Frau for 100 marks, not for 1,000 marks, to look like that. And, half dreaming, she imagined herself heaving up in her chair with the port wine bottle in her hand as the young man entered the cafe. Cold and dark the next morning, Sabina woke, tired, feeling as though something heavy had been pressing under her heart all night. There was a sound of footsteps shuffling along the passage. Herr Lehrmann, she must have overslept herself. Yes, he was rattling the door handle. One moment, she called, dragging on her stockings.
Bina, tell Anna to go to the Frau, but quickly, I must ride for the nurse.
Yes, yes, she cried. Has it come? But he had gone, and she ran over to Anna and shook her by the shoulder. The Frau, the baby, Herr Lehmann for the nurse, she stuttered.
Name of God,
said Anna, flinging herself out of bed. No complaints today. Importance, enthusiasm in Anna's whole bearing.
You run downstairs and light the oven. Put on a pan of water.
Speaking to an imaginary sufferer as she fastened her blouse.
Yes, yes, I know. We must be worse before we are better. I'm coming. Patience.
It was dark all that day. Lights were turned on immediately the cafe opened, and business was very brisk. Anna, turned out of the Frau's room by a nurse, refused to work, and sat in a corner nursing herself, listening to the sounds overhead. Hans was more sympathetic than Sabina. He also forsook work and stood by the window, picking his nose. But why must I do everything? Said Sabina, washing glasses. I can't help the Frau. She oughtn't to take such a time about it.
Listen, said Anna. They've moved her into the back bedroom over there, so as not to disturb the people. There was a groan. That one. 2 small beers, shouted Herr Lehrmann through the slide.
One moment. At 8 o'clock, the cafe was deserted. Sabina sat down in the corner without her sewing. Nothing seemed to have happened to the Frau. A doctor had come, that was all.
Ugh, said Sabina. I think no more of it. I listen no more. Ugh, I would like to go away. I hate this talk.
I will not hear it. No, it is too much. She leaned both her elbows on the table, cupped her face in her hands, and pouted. But the outer door, suddenly opening, she sprang to her feet and laughed. It was the young man again. He ordered more port, and brought no book this time.
"Don't go and sit miles away," he grumbled. "I want to be amused. And here, take my coat. Can't you dry it somewhere? Snowing again."
"There's a warm place, the ladies' cloakroom," she said. "I'll take it in there, just by the kitchen." She felt better, and quite happy again.
"I'll come with you," he said. "I'll see where you put it."
And that did not seem at all extraordinary. She laughed and beckoned to him. "In here," she cried. "Feel how warm. I'll put more wood on that oven. It doesn't matter, they're all busy upstairs." She knelt down on the floor and thrust the wood into the oven, laughing at her own wicked extravagance. The Frau was forgotten, the stupid day was forgotten. Here was someone beside her laughing too. They were together in the little warm room, stealing Herr Lehrmann's wood. It seemed the most exciting adventure in the world. She wanted to go on laughing, or burst out crying, or catch hold of the young man. "What a fire!" she shrieked, stretching out her hands.
"Here's a hand, pull up," said the young man. "There, now, you'll catch it tomorrow."
They stood opposite to each other, hands still clinging. And again, that strange tremor thrilled Sabrina.
"Look here," he said roughly. "Are you a child, or are you playing at being one?"
I... Laughter ceased. She looked up at him once, then down at the floor, and began breathing like a frightened little animal. He pulled her closer still and kissed her mouth. "No, what are you doing?" she whispered. He let go her hands, placed his on her breasts, and the room seemed to swim around Sabina. Suddenly, from the room above, a frightful, tearing shriek. She wrenched herself away, tightened herself, drew herself up. "Who did that? Who made that noise?" In the silence, the thin wailing of a baby. "Ugh!" shrieked Sabrina, rushing from the room.
I'm John MacDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was Harry Dobby reading Catherine Mansfield's short story At Lehrmann's. Time for some more music before our feature interview of the week. Let's hear Hut musician Darren Watson sing some John Hiatt from his latest album. Here he is with Lincoln Town.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. An old freight train, 5 miles long in the pouring rain, rolling out of Detroit, loaded up with shiny cars. And I'm sitting in a Cadillac smoking on a big cigar. What I feel's like an engine room. Open my burning up the atmosphere. When you hear me blow, honey babe, you know I'm here. Well, I'm going down Lincoln Town. Turn your pretty little head around. Take the next train outward bound. Carry you out of Lincoln Town. I an automobile, or maybe a freight train, depend on how you feel. Big wheels rolling, baby, till that engine whines. On rubber or steel, honey, baby, I don't mind.
And singing some John Hiatt, Lincoln Town. On Saturday, Staglands Cafe is the venue for bush poet Gregory North's tribute evening to the great Australian poet and journalist Andrew Banjo Paterson. Gregory is retracing the travels of Banjo Paterson's 1900 and 1901 tour around Australia and New Zealand. So before we hear a chat, let's start with some poetry from Gregory, written by Banjo Paterson.
Life in Australia can be tough, especially during drought. It's grand. It's grand to be a squatter and sit upon a post and watch your little ewes and lambs are giving up the ghost. It's grand to be a cocky with wife and kids to keep and find an all-wise providence has mustered all your sheep. It's grand to be a western man with shovel in your hand to dig your little homestead out from underneath the sand. It's grand to be a shearer along the Darling side and pluck the wool from stinking sheep that some days since have died. It's grand to be a rabbit and breed till all is blue and then to die in heaps because there's nothing left to chew. It's grand to be a minister and travel like a swell and tell the central district folk to go to Inverell. It's grand to be a socialist and lead the bold array that marches to prosperity at 7 bob a day. It's grand to be an unemployed and lie in the domain and wake up every second day and go to sleep again. It's grand to borrow English tin to pay for wharves and rocks and then to find it isn't in the little money box. It's grand to be a Democrat and toady to the mob for fear that if you told the truth, they'd hunt you from your job. It's grand to be a lot of things in this fair southern land, but if the Lord would send us rain, that would indeed be grand.
Gregory North, I'm reenacting Banjo Paterson's Boer War Lecture Tour.
A very big question to start with.
For people who don't know or don't remember, who was Banjo Paterson?
Banjo Paterson is Australia's most famous poet. He's credited with writing The Man from Stony River and also our unofficial national anthem, Waltzing Matilda.
Where did the name banjo come from?
Yeah, lots of people wonder if I'd be carrying an instrument. But no, banjo was the name of a so-called racehorse that his family owned when he was a child. And he was looking for a pen name when he was writing his poetry. He was writing mostly for The Bulletin, which was a bit of an edgy newspaper. And Andrew Barton Paterson, which is his correct name, was a solicitor. And he didn't necessarily want people to know he was writing for this edgy newspaper. So he used the pen name Banjo after the horse he knew as a child.
Now, he seems, I had a bit of a Google on him, as you do beforehand, and he seems to have quite considerable skills on many fronts. What do you sort of, with all your research, make of the skills that made him so popular?
Yeah, he was a man of many talents, I guess you'd say, but I think he's best known because of the humour in his poetry. He saw the country life and the characters that live there and made them live through the writings that he left.
Now, you describe yourself as a Banjo Paterson tragic on your website. How did you become in such a state?
I was introduced to him at school and I enjoyed the poems and didn't think much more about them. And when I went to high school, it was mostly English poets that I wasn't really excited about. But when I was about 35, I went to the local cafe poetry night in Katoomba, where I live in Australia, and saw people performing poetry. And I went, wow, why haven't I seen this before? This is fantastic. And it's a night that changed my life. And through that, I managed to become the resident poet in Winton in Queensland, which is where Banjo wrote Waltzing Matilda. And I thought, well, since I'm here in Winton, I probably should find out a bit more about Waltzing Matilda. And as I got more involved, it became a bit obsessive.
I mean, you've made a sort of a career out of it, really, haven't you? Because you have your Winton job based in Winton, don't you? Doing performances.
Yes, that's right. So, yeah, I have been making a living from it. And it's a great Aussie thing to do, to be a bush poet. Yeah, and it's a wonderful way to escape the winter in the Blue Mountains, which can be a bit cool, and entertain all the travellers that come through Winton. I perform at the caravan park there. There's been a poet in the caravan park for over 30 years, might even be close to 40 now.
Oh, right. Okay.
So that's a tradition that I'm continuing. And one of the hotels in Winton is called the North Gregory Hotel. And being Gregory North, I thought performing at the North Gregory Hotel would be a great thing. So I managed to talk my way in there. And I do a show there each day on Banjo Paterson or about Waltzing Matilda or what Winton was like when Banjo was there.
And you're there for months. You know, it's obviously quite a big season over there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So I spend 4 months there from Mother's Day to Father's Day, May till September. And there's, yeah, lots of people come through with their caravans and camper vans and travelling around.
And you've also done recordings and books, by lots of things, on Banjo's life and poetry.
Yeah, so I have a brief biography of Banjo's life and also put together a book about his Boer War experiences and the lecture tour that I'm reenacting as well.
What was his Boer War contribution?
He was a war correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and the Melbourne Argus newspapers in Australia, and he followed the New South Wales Lancers around, reporting on all the various battles and cabling it back to Sydney. And lots of people say that his reports of the Boer War were some of his most descriptive writing of his career. And when he got home, he was approached by an entrepreneur who'd been taking people, famous people around on musical tours or speaking tours, people like Mark Twain, for example. And he said to Banjo Paterson that you should do a lecture tour telling everyone all about the Boer War. So Banjo was convinced and he visited, I think it's 54 towns and did 90-odd lectures over 9 months. And I've got this crazy idea of following in his footsteps, going to the same places 125 years later.
Why? Why have you got this crazy idea? Where did that come from?
Part of it, I was booked to perform on a cruise, and the cruise got into Dunedin on the same day that Banjo Paterson was there 125 years earlier.
Oh, wow.
So I had toyed with the idea before, but when I saw that, I thought, oh, maybe that's a sign. I probably should do this. So that's what caused me to get into gear and start moving around the countryside.
So where are you talking from today, Gregory?
I'm in Lyttelton at the moment. I have a show here on Thursday night and heading off to Wellington tomorrow.
Where, what other sort of stops around New Zealand have you got on the tour?
I'm going to Wellington, Porirua, Upper Hutt, Featherston, Woodville. Now, I'm not sure if it's Fielding or Fielding.
Fielding.
It's got the letters around the wrong way. And I know Kiwis have challenges with vowels at the best of times, so I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah.
I'm still hoping to get something in Hastings or Napier and Whanganui. I do have a show in Hawira. I'm hoping for something in New Plymouth. And I've got also a show in Point Chevalier and hoping to get one in Auckland too.
And these are all sort of near the locations that Banjo Paterson did his 1901 tour, are they?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, 1900 and 1901. Yeah, he was going to return to Australia for 1901 because that's when the Federation Act festivities occurred. He'd been commissioned and wrote a poem for the event, but for some reason he stayed in New Zealand and extended his tour here. So he must have been well received, I think.
Good. Again, looking at the research, you know, when he was doing his Boer War journalist work, he was rubbing shoulders like with Winston Churchill and Rudyard Kipling. I mean, these are huge names that he was obviously up, you know, they were his peers, which is really quite mind blowing.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. When Banjo's granddaughters put together his complete works, they had a picture in there of a menu of a dinner that Banjo Paterson attended with all the officers in Bloemfontein in South Africa, and Rudyard Kipling was one of the guests there, and Banjo sat next to him, and Kipling wrote a few excerpts from some of his poems on the menu, and it said in the book that this was one of Banjo's treasured possessions. I have an autograph of Rudyard Kipling and a few excerpts from his poems.
What's the reaction been for your tour in both Australia and New Zealand so far?
I've had mostly quite enthusiastic audiences. In Dunedin, I was very surprised that we usually sing Waltzing Matilda as part of the show, and I think Dunedin has done the best job of any audience so far. They were terrific.
Yeah.
It's been up and down a bit. We've had as many as 121 people in Wagga Wagga, and as few as 8, I think it was, in Zeehan in Tasmania. There's been ups and downs, but people enjoy the shows, and lots of people say, oh, I don't know why there wasn't lots more people here. So please spread the word.
Are the younger generations aware of Banjo Paterson and the contribution he's made?
I think less and less, unfortunately. So that's another reason that I'm doing this tour, to try and bring him back to light, I suppose. Yeah. He's a very talented man, and he really captured the great spirit of Australian pioneers, I suppose you'd say.
So what's going to be involved in the performance in Upper Hutt? How do you run the night?
I talk about Banjo's life in general and intersperse it with several of his famous poems and a few that people may not have heard as well. And it's not a boring diatribe about what the Boer War was like. I think lots of people aren't even aware of the Boer War nowadays. So it's all about Banjo's life and lots of his great poems. And he had a very interesting life. Not only was he a war correspondent, but he travelled extensively throughout the world and Australia and New Zealand as well. And he was very much into horses and racing. He wrote a treatise on horse racing, which was never published during his lifetime, but does appear in the two big volumes that his granddaughters put together in the 1980s.
It was a very formative time too for Australia and New Zealand, I guess. So it was a very interesting time that he was around and documenting too.
Yeah, it certainly was. Australia was finding its identity, really. So he was one of those people helping to express that through his writings.
Could I also see you're performing Somerset Retirement Village at Trentham on Friday on the lead up to Staglands and Upper Hutt, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're also doing some of this as a joint fundraiser for local charities, I believe, as part of the tour.
Yeah, I'm trying to get clubs and things involved. I do have a show with Lions in Hawira. The idea is to share the profits with those community groups so that they can make some money and I can also get an audience. been only one like that in Hastings or Napier or Whanganui or New Plymouth or Auckland. I'd love to be in contact.
Yeah, I mean, things like Lions and Rotary are all around the country, really, aren't they? It's sort of probably the same with Australia, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
You describe yourself as a bush poet on your website. So what's your definition of a bush poet?
Well, we have the Australian Bush Poets Association that defines bush poetry as poetry with rhyme and rhythm about Australia, Australians, or the Australian way of life. So it's pretty broad, but essentially it's that rhyming and rhythm that goes along with it, which is the way that Banjo Paterson wrote his poetry and is still going strong today.
Why have you identified as a bush poet, you know, in this day and age? What's been the traction for you?
I think I and lots of audiences do also enjoy that rhyme and rhythm. There's an expectation at the end of the line that it's going to be a rhyme, and that often builds the anticipation and makes it more satisfying when you hear it, I think.
Does the period in history, is your material historic, or are you quite contemporary in the work that you're doing?
Yeah, most of the poems I write are about contemporary Australia. Banjo wrote about things in his day, and modern bush poets write about things in our day.
Right.
So I have poems about tofu and cake and carpet stores and all sorts of things.
Yeah, okay. Now, the best place for people to get information on your work and your tour, where, Gregory, would that be?
My website's the best spot. It's gregorynorth.com.au, and there's a list of where I'll be and where I'm hoping to go. So that'll give people a good idea of where and when and where to get tickets and all that sort of thing.
So the logistics for the Upper Hutt gig, it's next Saturday, so the 6th of December, 7 p.m. at the Staglands Cafe in Upper Hutt. Tickets from the iTickets website, and Taranaki also has details on that. Your message, Gregory, to Hutt Zone radio listeners on coming along on Saturday night, what would that message of encouragement be?
Please come and hear about a great Australian and be entertained by some of his wonderful writings.
Now, I thought we'd go out with a recording from a YouTube channel of Waltzing Matilda, and it's got an interesting story on who Banjo Paterson collaborated with and what that meant to his long-term fiancé. Can you give us a sort of a short backstory of the creation of Waltzing Matilda first?
Yeah, it was really a way of impressing the ladies that were there. He went to Winton to visit his fiancée that he'd been engaged to for 7 years and met her friend. And there's the rumour that he may have had a bit of a dalliance with her friend and wrote the song to impress her, and maybe something happened during the intimate moments as they were putting together the words. And not long afterwards, or sometime around that time, the seven-year engagement between Banjo and his fiancée ended. So maybe it was because of the song, and Banjo never spoke about it for the rest of his life, and those two ladies never married.
Oh, there once was a swagman camped in the billabong under the shade of a coolabah tree, and he sang as he looked at the old billy boiling, "Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me? Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda, my darling? Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me? Waltzing Matilda and leading a water bag. Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me?" Down came a jumbuck to drink at the waterhole. Up jumped the swagman and grabbed him with glee. And he sang as he put him away in his tucker bag, "You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Oh, who'll come a-waltzing Matilda, my darling? Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me? Waltzing Matilda and leading a water bag. Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me?" Down came the squatter, a-riding on his thoroughbred. Down came the policeman, one, two, three. "Whose is the jumbuck you've got in the tucker bag? You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda, my darling? Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me? Waltzing Matilda and leading a water bag. Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me?" But the swagman, he up and he jumped in the waterhole, drowning himself by the Coolabah tree. And his ghost may be heard as it sings in the billabong, "Who come a waltzing Matilda with me?" Ah, who come a waltzing Matilda, my darling? Who come a waltzing Matilda with me? Waltzing Matilda and leading a water bag. Who come a waltzing Matilda with me? Ah, who come a waltzing Matilda, my darling? Who come a waltzing Matilda with me? Waltzing Matilda and leading a water bag. Who come a waltzing Matilda with me?
I'm John McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was Gregory North sharing Banjo Patterson's poetry and music. He's in Upper Hutt this Saturday night at Staglands. More details and tickets from the Whirinaki website. But that means it's the end of this week's show. Thanks to all my guests tonight, and a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. You can always listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hut Zone pages of accessradio.org.nz. If you have a suggestion of a Hut story or a piece of music or poetry, then please do message us, either on Facebook, John McDonald NZ, or email the team, and our email is thehutzone@outlook.co.nz. Let's go out with some music from Cantorus Choir, who have their Christmas concert on Saturday afternoon at St. Peter's Church on Williston, Wellington. Let's start Christmas in the Hut Zone with Joy to the World. Ma te wa e noho oru mai ra. Stay well.
Joy to the world, the Lord is come, let every sea.
The program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.